At Mayo Clinic in Arizona, we're treating the untreatable, developing personalized cancer vaccines to treat the disease and prevent it from recurring. Learn more at mayoclinic.org/possible. Mayo Clinic, you know where to go.
Optimize your nutrition with Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal service. Factor's fresh, never-frozen meals are dietitian-approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from 40 weekly options across 8 dietary preferences like Calorie Smart and Protein Plus. Factor's keto meals can help you lose up to 8 pounds in 8 weeks. Get started at factormeals.com/factor50off to get 50% off, plus free shipping on your first box. Weight loss with Factor Keto based on a randomized controlled clinical trial. Results will vary depending on diet and exercise.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
The horror knife attack in Stony Batter on Sunday afternoon has raised the issue of knife crime and whether or not we should be taking it more seriously. Joining me now is columnist and retired consultant in emergency medicine, Dr. Chris Luke. Chris, good afternoon.
Hi, Anton. Good afternoon.
Chris, you've written about this and that having faced the damage caused by knife attacks in your time in emergency medicine. How significant an issue is it and was it in your view?
Well, it's something which I worry about. I certainly, in my youth when I was working in St. James's in the inner city in Dublin, we'd see the odd Stanley knife attack. So that per se is nothing new. And I also saw examples in the inner city in Edinburgh and Liverpool. Less so, I think, in Cork in the last few years. But certainly Stanley knives were always used on, particularly to inflict sort of disfiguring injuries. And one of the sort of classics of late night inner city emergency department presentations would be the Stanley knife that is drawn from the angle of the mouth right up towards the ear. And that leaves, obviously, a permanent disfigurement. So I've been worried about knife crime for years, and certainly one of the first cases I ever dealt with as a youngster was somebody who had a knife plunged into his heart. So it's something which is, literally engraved on my frontal lobes. And I'm really concerned about the levels of knife crime in the UK. We've heard of the horror of Southport there, where the girls were all attacked. The horror of the nighttime attack in Nottingham, where three people were killed by Valdo Caldicane, a schizophrenic who had been sectioned on numerous occasions, but was released into the community despite having attacked a lot of people beforehand, and on it goes. I mean, if you look at the cities of London and Bristol, you'll see that they have endemic knife crime problems, with dozens of teenagers, for example, killed by other teenagers every year. So it's something I worry about, because in my experience, whatever is going on in the UK, it tends to eventually percolate over here, because we tend to live very similar, lifestyles.
The difficulty, I suppose, though, is what do you do to prevent it? Because if it was gun crime, you could talk about gun licensing and accessibility, but it is going to be impossible, one assumes, to make knives unavailable. And the kind of precursor behaviours, whether it be a mental health problem or a drug problem or even just a violence problem, is it possible to infer a pattern of behaviour where you'd say, I think this person is a knife crime threat?
Well, I would like to say so. I mean, the perpetrator of the Southport murders and, a massacre, really. I mean, he'd been very, very violent, for many years before he was arrested at the scene of the massacre in Southport at the age of about 17. So he'd been in and out of police stations and in and out of psychiatric assessment, and he'd made terrible threats within school premises again and again and again. And I'd like to think that, that sort of person is obviously out of control, and they really need preemptive dealing with. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the underlying causes of violence and, knife violence are much the same. They involve, severe deprivation, particularly emotional deprivation. They involve people growing up in chaotic, drug and drink, riddled houses. And they also involve people who unfortunately live in neighborhoods that are disfigured by crime and litter and are generally frightening place to live. And then you add in things like mental health. I mean, for example, one of the rules of thumb I've always picked up from psychiatric colleagues is that it's very rare for schizophrenics or paranoid schizophrenics to be violent unless you throw in some element of substance misuse, a so-called dual diagnosis. And then, of course, you have things like, you know, homelessness, and throw that in, and the people living in fear, you know, day in, day out, and who, you know, reach for, you know, they tend to acquire a weapon to have under the blanket because they're forever being threatened or attacked. So you're absolutely right. It's a very, very vexed and fraught question. But, you know, one has to be positive. And I'm convinced that, you know, things like the violence reduction unit in Glasgow, which saw a 65% reduction in the level of knife crime there, is the sort of model that we need to learn from. So, you know, I'm always positive, and I've been involved in prevention over many, many years. I mean, we were effective in the 1990s in Liverpool with, for example, car offenders and their recidivism rate. So, yeah, you know, I think there's plenty that we can do.
Now, a lot of that is going to have to be rooted in having good data, because the kind of things that you're describing about whether it be an impoverished background, whether it be an abusive childhood, whether it be a drug addiction, whether it be a psychosis, how good are we at collating and codifying those causative behaviours so that we can infer those patterns?
Well, we're not very good, Anton. I mean, basically, you know, I'd suggest that we're about 10 to 20 years behind the trauma systems, for example, in Australia. You know, they are, but of course, they have very highly resourced trauma centres, trauma data capture, and so on. But we are catching up quite quickly. I mean, we have the National Office for Clinical Audit, for example, run by Professor Connor Deasy, that is capturing data on hip fractures and head injuries and so on. That's up and running for the last number of years. We have two trauma centres in evolution in Dublin and Cork, and the people there are being trained up in terms of both culture and skills. And fundamental to both of those services is the idea of data capture. And I've long suggested that whenever there's a case of severe, you know, life-threatening or limb-threatening violence, that the situation should be considered akin to someone being stopped for drink or drug driving, and that we should be doing toxicology tests routinely when we're concerned about a possible homicide or severe assault. I think otherwise people continue to poo-poo the idea that there is a correlation between, you know, drug taking and violence. So we've a way to go, but I'm optimistic.
We also, I assume, have a way to go in terms of culture, because the way that you are describing assessing or doing toxicology tests on the perpetrator is to seek to understand them rather than seeking to demonize them, which I assume is a fairly natural reaction if they have maimed or murdered.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a wonderful series of Reith lectures this year, Anton. There, you know, for those who don't know, the Reith lectures, Lord Reith was the chap who founded the BBC back in the 1920s. And every year there's a series of lectures by an expert. This year was by Gwen Adshead. She's a forensic psychiatrist in Broadmoor and that sort of place. And she gave a wonderful series of lectures on the whole issue of violence. And she emphasized the point that, you know, brutalizing particularly teenage perpetrators merely makes the matter worse. It amplifies, it exacerbates. So you've always got to be constructive and look towards places like Norway, where they have, you know, very systematic and well-resourced facilities to sort of give people skills for psychotherapy and analysis of their backstory. And again, ultimately, the idea that, you know, people can change, and that evil is not necessarily a sort of permanent fixture of someone's character, but it's often a reaction to an external threat or a very, very difficult backstory. So again, as I say, you know, we have to be data-driven, be evidence-based and so forth. And also, as I say, there's no point in, you know, this whole idea of vengeance and eye for an eye is, in terms of the scientific experience, and of course, in terms of the cost of imprisoning people, is something that I don't think has worked very well in the past, Chris, the past sort of 50 years or so.
Chris, thank you very much. That is Dr. Chris Luke, who is consultant, rather retired consultant in emergency medicine, current columnist.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.
At Mayo Clinic in Arizona, we're treating the untreatable. Developing personalized cancer vaccines to treat the disease and prevent it from recurring. Learn more at mayoclinic.org/possible. Mayo Clinic. You know where to go.